Hello, and welcome to the Comic Book Page Podcast. My name is John Mayo, and I'll be your host. This episode is the 2006 Year in Review, and covers the sales estimates for the top comics and trades of 2006. And yeah, we are a good ways into 2007 already. But it took a while to get all of the data for 2006 into a consistent format and condense it down into something a bit more manageable. Even after all that work, it was still a lot of information to analyze and discuss. I decided to break the discussion up into two parts. The first part, I'm joined by Bob Breitel, JLA fan of the Comic Geek Speak forums, to discuss the comic book sales for 2006. In the second part, I'm joined by Chris Marshall of the Collected Comics Library podcast to discuss the sales of trades and hardbacks for the year. I want to thank both Bob and Chris for taking the time to join me in these discussions. I greatly appreciate it. I've put a link to the Excel workbook that we used as the basis for the discussions up on my website, www.comicbookpage.com. Simply use the drop-down menus to go to the 2006 summary page. You can find it under the Mayo Reports section of the Sales Charts menu. So, just click on the Sales Charts, go down to the Mayo Report, go down to 2006, and then the 2006 Summary option. It'll pull up the page with the Year in Review article I did for Comic Book Resources, and there'll be a link to the Excel file at the end of the first paragraph on that page. And if you haven't taken a chance to look through my website and all the other sales information I've got there, you know, please do so. I'm in the process of reworking some of it and fixing some of the problems it has, and I'd greatly appreciate any feedback you might have. Now, while you don't need to follow along in the Excel file, it might be fun to do so. There was a ton of data to go over, and we really only scratched the surface of it. One thing I want to point out up front is that the top comics and trades lists for 2006 were ranked lists with no indication of how each item did. I used the data from the monthly information to get ballpark figures of how well the items could have done. These numbers are only used to get an idea of what range the item might have sold in. They are certainly not exact figures by any means, and they're much looser than the average monthly data I've got. Please don't read too much into those numbers. Again, they're just there to give kind of a ballpark idea of how the items did. Also, the audio quality on my side of the conversations isn't perfect, but it is understandable. The program I used to record the Skype calls had some problems that I think have since been fixed that caused the pops and glitches you're going to hear. I apologize for that, and hopefully future recordings will sound better. And now, here's the discussion that Bob and I had on the comic book sales for 2006 while going over that Excel file I mentioned. Okay, so let's go over the top comics for 2006. We have the top 300 sellers for the year, and then we'll go over the monthly data. So let's start with the top 300 comics of 2006. I don't think there's any huge surprises that things that topped the list were things like Civil War, relaunches like Justice League of America, and, you know, other event titles like Infinite Crisis and 52. The only thing that really jumped out at me as slightly surprising, although not hideously surprising, out of the top 300 comics, all of them were Marvel and DC. Marvel took the lion's share with 181 of the top 300, and DC obviously came in second with the remaining 119. Now, it's not hideously surprising. What's interesting is this year Diamond released the top 300. In the past couple of years, they've only released the top 100 sellers for the year. And in, I guess it was 2003, there was an independent comic on the list with, I guess that was Transformers Generation 1 by Dreamwave, which opened really strong when it first came out. Every issue of 52 is on the top 300 for the year, which is no surprise. Other titles that had numerous issues show up were Ultimate Spider-Man with 15 issues, Uncanny X-Men with 14, X-Men with 14, and Batman, New Avengers, and Wolverine all came in with 12 each. So there are a number of titles that are clearly very strong selling titles on a routine basis. But I was really astounded by how many, particularly at the top of the list, were things that I would categorize as clearly event comics of one variety or another. Either obvious events like Civil War, or, you know, more subtle events like a relaunch or something like Justice by Alex Ross, things that aren't kind of your run-of-the-mill comics. What really jumped out at you, Bob?
Looking at this list, the one that was a little interesting to me was how high All-Star Batman and Robin number 4 came in. Was that the issue with that big 6-page fold-out of the Batcave?
Yes, yes.
Okay, so that explains it. But it came in at 17, and given how universally panned that series has been among the fan community anyway, I was very surprised to see that in the top 20 for the year.
Well, there are a few other things that make that issue, you know, kind of unique on this list. One, it's the latest comic on this list, 23 weeks late. It's also the only issue of All-Star Batman and Robin the Boy Wonder that came out in 2006. And, of course, since it was so late, it should have come out in 2005. So, it's, you know, I think that that's a huge missed opportunity for DC, because, yeah, I agree. Everyone who talks about it seems to hate it. But, I mean, like you said, it ranked 17 on the list. It's selling.
Yeah, well, I'll admit I bought one. You know, it's a... I saw that, you know, it's like that giant 6-page fold-out of the Batcave by Jim Lee. I mean, I don't care how crappy Frank Miller's writing's been on the series. I wanted to have that big 6-page fold-out of the Batcave with all the detail that Jim Lee put into it. So, hey, I'm not that surprised, you know, that it did sell. But then on the other hand, it was a standout for me when I looked at the list here.
Yeah, it does seem to be, you know, a little out of place compared to everything else. Because, really, again, you look at the top of the list, most of the things are either clear event titles, crossover to events, so like some of the issues of New Avengers, some of the issues of Amazing Spider-Man, things of that nature. A couple of relaunches, like Wonder Woman number 1, Flash number 1, a couple of new titles, like Wolverine Origins number 1. It seems you can go quite a ways down the list before you hit anything that was a strong seller, but not kind of, I don't want to say a sales gimmick, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, Supergirl number 5, I'm just scanning down, that came in at 106. That's the first one that seems like it's not some kind of a event or tied in with some of the other stuff, you know. So like you were saying, you know, we got Justice, which is Alex Ross, so that's going to sell, and you got, you know, your other tie-ins and things like that. I guess Superman Batman number 26 was that was the Jeff Loeb son tribute issue, right?
Right, right.
So that's why that one's way up there. But you got to go pretty far down. Like I said, you know, 106 with Supergirl is the first one that I see that's not kind of a first issue or something that's got an X-Man or Wolverine or somebody in it that you kind of expect it to be, you know, ranked very high. And I'm not remembering off the top of my head what was special about Supergirl number 5.
I'm wondering if that was the first 1 year later issue. And it might have been.
Well, Supergirl number 4 is coming in not that much lower. I mean, it's 122, but it's... You know, so Supergirl seems to be holding her own there pretty well, and you got Supergirl 6, you know, another 20 slots down. So there are several Supergirls in there.
Yeah.
Kind of scanning down the list and, you know, just ones that are... I'm not really surprised by most of the things that are on this list. They're very standard in that, you know, Spider-Man is always going to be a seller. Things with the X-Men, things with Batman, things
exactly.
With Superman. These are the most recognizable heroes that we have, and number one issues, again, you know, those are always going to pop onto people's radars somewhere or another.
Actually, one that kind of jumps out at me is down at rank 189 with Onslaught Reborn number 1.
My eyes ran by that, and then I refrained from commenting, but it is a number one, you know.
It's a number one, but it fits that same kind of category as All-Star Batman and Robin the Boy Wonder, whereas people seem to universally almost despise it, yet it still sells.
Yeah. Did you get one?
Yeah. Yeah, I did.
Yeah, there you go. I got one, too. Yeah. And it was 74 cents from DCBS, so it's like I could not get one. I didn't get issue number 2, though.
You know, I'd be hard-pressed to name anything on this list I didn't get.
I'm probably there with you, unless the aforementioned Onslaught Reborn number 2 is somewhere on this list, because I know I didn't get that. Now, Wildcats, that's another one. I bought the first issue. That's coming in at $2.35, but I fled screaming in the other direction from that one also. I did not pick up number 2 of that.
Actually, that may be one of the ones I didn't get. I stayed out of the relaunch of the Wildstorm stuff, and it seems like a lot of people made that decision also. It did not relaunch all that well.
I got the first issues of everything, and I did not order, I didn't pre-order the second issues, and the only thing I came back for an issue 2 on out of all the Wildstorm books were Midnighter and Deathblow.
Interesting. And I just checked. I did get Wildcats number 1. It was a gift from Sean at over at Raging Bullets when we were at CGS 200. But yeah, again, I'm not surprised that the Ultimate line shows very strong, like you were saying, with the X-Men titles, Spider-Man, Batman. These, you know, in the cases of particularly Spider-Man, X-Men, and Batman, strong characters, these are always going to be, you know, good sellers. I don't think there's a single non-superhero title on this list.
Oh, well, yeah. Well, given that it's Marvel and DC only, that pretty much paints us in. I mean, there's a couple of Punisher titles, and you might, you know, whether Punisher is a superhero or not is debatable under some.
Well, it's Punisher War Journal, which standards. Is bringing him back into the Marvel Universe. So
yeah, true.
I'd argue that one kind of fits as a superhero title.
Yeah, I can give you that. But there's not a lot of diversity in the titles that actually made it on here.
I would agree with that entirely. A lot of these are variations on the standard themes. And really, it doesn't venture too far out of kind of the core roster of characters from Marvel and DC.
You're right. There's a couple of extra characters. I mean, certainly, you know, the first issues or a relaunch are going to do good. I mean, you'll get a Moon Knight or Eternals or something from Marvel. And you've got some Green Lantern and Flash on here, but it's mostly the big guns from the companies that are in here. And this, what this is telling me is the companies know what the fans like, the fans know what the fans like, and you know the lion's share of people come out and they buy these books in droves. Given the average sales, you know, on books that are, you know, where they get canceled down around 21,000, 22,000. I mean, the number 300 on here was selling 67,000 or so. Yeah. So, you know, this is doing triple what a mainstream book in danger of cancellation is selling. And indie books sell, in many cases, far less than that 20,000-21,000 threshold.
Well, it's interesting because virtually everything on this list is either one of the core, you know, franchises or characters from Marvel and DC, or, you know, a variation of it. And, you know, all of these basic properties have been around for, you know, a minimum of 20 years, more like, you know, 40 or 60 in some cases. I mean, you could argue a little with something like Ultimates, but that's essentially a variation on the Avengers, which again has been around, you know, forever. It kind of implies that the average reader, or not necessarily the average reader, but most readers want something they're familiar with, want something they're comfortable with, and want something that's got a history to it, which kind of, you know, goes counter to the fact that a lot of these comics, you know, have issue numbers, you know, below 12 in a lot of cases.
That's true. That's true. and you can tell where the relaunches have been successful too. Like, for instance, you look at Green Lantern, which they relaunched, and Green Lantern issues 7 through 15 are all on this list somewhere
right.
or another.
Right.
But you look at the Ghost Rider relaunch.
You get the first issue and that's it.
And there's nothing else. And, you know, the movie, you know, notwithstanding, you know, Heroes for Hire. You have the first issue, nothing else.
Right.
Well, same with Moon Knight.
Well, Moon Knight's got 4 issues done here. You got 1, 2, 3, and then it skips up to 6. Now, 6 was a Civil War crossover of some sort.
And I think it had multiple covers.
Yeah. Oh, that's the one with that bloody variant, I think.
Yes.
Yeah. But, you know, Ms. Marvel, number 1, shows up on here. None of the other ones show up on here, which is interesting. And, you know, so I look at this and it tells me that, like, some of these relaunches resonated and others did not. Now, I look at Wonder Woman and only 3 issues came out because that series was just so way late. But all 3 of the issues charted here in the top 300, so that just looks like a missed opportunity, because I think that whatever issues they put out would have charted.
Oh, agreed. I think there are a number of titles like that where the only reason we don't see more of them on the list is because they couldn't get around to getting more out. But the whole concept of a relaunch resonating or not, I think, was a huge factor in 2006, more so than most years, because between the various high-profile relaunches coming out of Infinite Crisis, there was also, you know, all the 1 year later kind of revamps and retoolings. And while they may not have gotten number ones, there was a definite jumping on and jumping off point to be had on most titles for DC this year. And it's interesting to see, you know, how few of those really seem to stick for any, you know, length of time. You know, people will try that first issue. I think the fact that we see so many number ones on this list is a clear indication that people want to find new things to read. But it also goes to your point of how few number twos there seem to be. And, you know, a lot of these readers are not finding a lot of these titles to their liking for whatever reason. I think that just goes to publishers and creators not being able to keep an existing reader once they've gotten them to try out the book. And I think that's equally important to getting new readers.
I also find it interesting with the 52 phenomenon, and I'll call it a phenomenon just because they put out 34 issues in 2006. Every one of them shipped on time. And every one of them's in the top 300. So, I mean, you look at that, and they're selling. I mean, they dipped off near the end of the year to just a hair under 100,000 copies. But in general, the issues of 52 have been selling, you know, what, about 110, 115 on average, you know, tailing off. Let's say 110, because they started out around 120-ish, and then they ended up close to 100. But they crowded how many other titles? And if there wasn't a 52, there would be a lot of other titles with lower numbers.
Yeah,
I'd wager.
Well, because
populating this list.
Yeah, because over 10% of this list is 52.
Right.
You know, 34 out of 300, certainly. And I agree, it's definitely a phenomenon in a number of ways, because, like you said, weekly, every week on time, that in and of itself is something to be commended, both for the, you know, the creative team, the publishers, the editors, everyone. But it's something that, you know, invariably based on its success, they're going to try to replicate. But I think there's so many factors in terms of the bubble of continuity that they'd carved out for it, and it not having really been done before, that contributed to the success, that I really have a hard time picturing a follow-up 52-style series doing as well.
Certainly, you had a beautiful launch vehicle of Infinite Crisis leading right into 52, and they had a tremendous, at least within the industry, marketing push onto it. They also just, you know, made a splash with, you know, those first issues with the returnability policy that really warded against the shops under-ordering because they were unsure about this thing.
Agreed.
That, so there was a lot of things that played together, I think, that caused this to do as well as it did.
Yeah, and the returnability for the first 12 issues, I think, had a lot to do with its success, like you pointed out. Because had the stores not had that kind of safety net, I'm sure they would have ordered a lot more conservatively, and the thing would have just started out at a lower starting point and gone down from there.
And I think that a lot of this, you know, we got to take into account that the data is what the data is, and that's sales to comic shops.
True.
And not necessarily sell through to consumers. But in the case of 52, I believe there are sold out issues, but even so, you can go into a lot of your more well-stocked comic stores and find issues of 52 going most of the way back to number one. I mean, not tremendous amounts. I don't think that comic stores have pallets of the things laying around. But I do think that helps keep the momentum up because people can go back since the store didn't order exactly to cover what the people on the pull list wanted and nothing else.
Right.
That's a barrier to entry. You know, if I don't find out about 52 until issue 13 and I'm not able to pick up those back issues, I wouldn't pick it up.
Right? Certainly, certainly. I have to wonder, though, how much of a barrier to entry the price became further down the line. Even if all the previous issues are available, I have to wonder how many people were willing to, you know, come week 20 or after that or whatever the threshold point would be. You know, I've got to imagine readers were starting to do the math at that point, saying, yeah, I've heard great things about it, but, you know, 250 times however many issues adds up.
Oh, yeah. You know, certainly there's a sweet spot there. You know, the first, if you catch somebody within the first 2-3 months of this, you know, up to about issue 12. There's not so many issues back there that it's going to be a barrier. But you're right. I mean, if somebody found out about it around issue 20, 25, they're probably not going to go back and spend, you know, $80 or $90 buying all the issues that have come out to date.
Well, at least not all at once. They may do it in stages, yeah. Whatever. But yeah. Well, shall we move on to the month-by-month breakdowns?
Sure.
All right. What I did for this is I totaled up all the top 300 for each month just to kind of get a sense for how Marvel and DC were doing versus the overall market. And I did some comparisons on items, units, and dollars, both to the previous month and to the same month of the previous year. Now, what I found kind of interesting with this was there were, you know, a few months in particular that were real pivotal times in the year. Certainly for DC, May was one of them. Between 52, 1 year later, and the last issue of Infinite Crisis, DC managed to bump up their sales by 1 million units from April to May. And that kind of huge upswing in a month is just incredible. Marvel, on the other hand, seemed to be a lot more consistent overall, with their big month being November, in which they had a similar, you know, million unit bump from the previous month. And it seems that, you know, on average, DC's doing about 40% market share by units, you know, give or take, you know, 4 or 5% during the course of the year. Marvel's doing about 46.5%, again, give or take, you know, 4 or 5%. And really, you know, that seems to kind of crowd out the independent comics, because, you know, on average, they seem to only account for about 14% of the unit sales. And that's interesting because, you know, they also account for about, 120 or so of the top 300 items in any given month. So, clearly, I mean, obviously, you know, Marvel and DC dominate the industry. That's no surprise. That's no news. But they seem to be doing it, you know, to an increasing degree over previous years.
So, when the data that we're looking at here, you have the unit market share, you have the dollar market share for Marvel and DC, and you have a lot of other data on here as well. But the question I have is, if I add up the unit market share, you know, they're both close, right? Mm-hmm. Unit and dollar market share for a given company. But they add up to about 85% of the total market. Now, are there other things besides indie comics in this total amount? Do we have graphic novels in here, or is this just comics?
This is just comics, and specifically just the top 300 comics for each month.
Okay.
So it does not include trades, it does not include hardbacks, doesn't include toys.
Okay, and it doesn't include the Marvel and DC titles. That was the piece that I was missing. So it doesn't include the Marvel and DC titles that fall below the top 300.
Correct.
Right,
and
okay.
I'd be surprised if there are any Marvel and DC that do, other than reorder activity. But certainly no indie comics that fall below the 300. And at some point, I'm going to actually start digging through the shipping lists and get a count for how many items actually do ship in a given month, and just see potentially how many items are dropping below that top 300 list each month. But by my count, anywhere from, 11 to 16% of the units sold are indie comics, and by dollars, it's about, you know, again, 12 to 16%. So a noticeable percentage, but again, that's all of the independent companies. That's Image, Dark Horse, Viz, Tokyo Pop. I'm trying to think of some of the others that would be on that list every month. But, I mean, you get the idea.
Do the mangas count in comics or in collected trade numbers?
Typically, the mangas are going to be over in the trade section. It's kind of a blurry line as to what Diamond, you know, considers a trade versus a graphic novel versus a comic book. You wind up with monthly things showing up on the trades list based on the number of pages and the price point, but they sell more along comic book sales trend lines because of the frequency. And then sometimes you'll see a few things on the top comics list that, based on their page count and their size and them being a one-shot, you could argue maybe they should have been in the trades. But typically the manga, because of the price point and the page count, are going to be over on the top trade section.
Any other observations about the top? I mean, I see a very healthy industry. I mean, the top 300 are accounting for a decent amount of dollars over the course of the year. You know, we've got, between Marvel and DC, a little over $250 million.
Yeah. The one thing I found kind of interesting is the average change on a monthly basis in the market share by units for DC is up about 0.5%, and for Marvel it's down about 0.3%. So there's the chance that DC is going to start, you know, catching up on market share on average to Marvel. But given how much of this year was filled with, you know, major events like, you know, Infinite Crisis, 52, Civil War, one year later, all the relaunches, I would be reluctant to really, you know, base any huge trends based on the 2006 performance.
Well, both companies seem to really have hitched their wagons to a big event model where they seem to have lost sight of how to capture an audience's attention in absence of there being some big event going on.
I agree entirely. And I think this trend goes back 2 or 3 years. On the DC side, you know, you can trace back through 1 year later, 52, you know, Infinite Crisis, the build-up miniseries to Infinite Crisis, Identity Crisis. You can go all the way back to the Young Justice Teen Titans Graduation Day miniseries, which is really some of the first seeds that were planted that led up to kind of where we are now. On the Marvel side, you have all the events, you know, with Avengers Disassembled, House of M, Decimation, and the various things they've used to tie all those together up through Civil War. And we do seem to be in almost a perpetual event state, even to the point where concurrent events are going on within the same publisher. I think Annihilation totally got overshadowed by Civil War. I think DC made a very interesting choice to do both 52 and 1 year later the way they did. And while they were both good ideas, I felt they were kind of nebulously marketed to where you kind of sort of understood what the idea was, but not entirely.
Well, I think 52, they did a good job of marketing. The 1 year later, I didn't get the same strong feeling that outside of, you know, the direct comics industry. I mean, that was a relaunch, but they didn't seem to really take advantage of that, especially with a lot of the big name people that they got back on titles working on them. And they had some pretty decent creators working on a lot of those 1 year later titles.
It was a good move. It was a good idea, but I agree they didn't take as good of advantage as they could have of it. There were a few that came out of the gate really strong, but then the minute the next story arc started, it was almost, I don't want to say another relaunch, but a different enough in tone, direction, and creative team that I felt they really lost some momentum. Add to that a number of these titles had some major delays, both in terms of, you know, huge delays with Wonder Woman. There were some pretty noticeable delays on Green Lantern. They didn't come out of the gate as strong as they should have with 1 year later, and with as many issues in the can as they should have. It's still a little early to see how the trades are going to do for 1 year later, but overall, I think most of the titles are below where they were just prior to 1 year later. So any sales bump they did get, and most of them got some pretty good ones, they've already lost, which is unfortunate.
Well, of course, I think delays really do kill momentum. And Green Lantern, I mean, there were some delays, but they still had like 7 or 8 of those come out in the course of 2006, you know, compared to like 3 issues of Flash and 3 issues of Wonder Woman. And maybe that's, you know, a lack of the Hollywood factor. I think when you get some of these Hollywood guys involved, you're just asking for it.
Oh, I totally agree with that. You've got people who have higher paying jobs doing other stuff. The comics aren't going to be their main priority. That's kind of a given. And it's surprising how Marvel and DC in particular don't seem to factor that in on their planning. You would think if you're going to get, you know, a big name, you know, Hollywood creator, particularly ones that have a reputation in some cases for being late, you'd build up inventory of the scripts and stuff and, you know, budget the time accordingly to where you don't have these major delays. And in 2007, it's going to be interesting to see how that pans out. We're already seeing a lot of doubled-up solicitations for Wonder Woman. It'll be interesting to see if Marvel decides to try to catch up on the number of issues for the titles that got delayed with Civil War or not. Or if we hit, you know, further delays on other things. But certainly that does seem to kill momentum on monthly titles. But again, that's one of the things that 52 is proven, that, you know, comics can come out on time.
True.
So, any other comments on the top comics for 2006?
Not on the 300 list, no.
Because that's pretty much all I got, both on the monthly and the top comics for the year.
Now, your top comics by title, you've got things that go beyond the top 300 list.
Yeah, what I did is I took all of the comics for 2006 that showed up on the top 300, simply grouped them by title, did a count of the number of items, the minimum units, maximum units sold, same for price and dollars, just to get a feel for how much titles were either costing readers and how much they brought in. Obviously, one of the more interesting ones was 52, which had, you know, like we said before, 34 issues come out during 2006. And it sold about 3.75 million units over the course of those 34 issues. And that brought in for DC, or brought in at retail price, I should say, almost $9.5 million for just that one title.
And that's a lot of money.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, it's interesting because some of that's obviously going to go to the distributor, some's going to go to the retailer, some's going to go to the publisher, some, you know, to the creators and stuff. I mean, so that's by and large good for everybody. The most profitable comic was, of course, 52. The second one to bring in the most was, of course, Civil War, which did just under $5 million. Over the course of the five issues.
And it pumped up the sales of a tremendous number of other books. That's one thing I will give Marvel credit for that I don't believe happened similarly at DC. I mean, 52 brought in a lot, but 52 is relatively self-contained. Since everything else happened, it's like 1 year later, people can read 52 and it doesn't necessarily pump up the sales of everything else, whereas Civil War had a lot of tie-in issues that,
yeah,
granted, had lots of delays associated with them because of the core delays for Civil War, but still, you had a lot of issues of FF and Spider-Man and Iron Man and,
well, it's interesting,
even
because
Moon Knight that were charting because of their Civil War tie-in.
Well, a lot of the Civil War tie-ins on not necessarily the top-tier books, more the lower tiers, with things like Ms. Marvel, Thunderbolts, She-Hulk, even Black Panther. Over the course of 2006, when they did the crossover issues, those issues tended to sell 2 to 3 times what the series had been doing. So you can, compensate for, you know, a few issues not coming out if the ones that do sell so much better than average for the title. I think it was Thunderbolts that had, again, nearly a, you know, tripling of sales during the crossover issues. So certainly I think Civil War was a huge success in that regard. What's interesting, though, is just, you know, the minute the crossover stops, sales drop right back to pretty much where they had been. There seemed to be very little carryover beyond the crossover.
That's true.
There are a couple of cases where there were some, but that was much more the exception rather than the rule. But even top-tier titles like Spider-Man, Fantastic Four, New Avengers saw some very healthy bumps from Civil War.
But this is a business, right? So you think back and look at it and say, well, gee, maybe this is why we're seeing everything being related to a crossover lately. Because somebody's looking at it and saying, look, we're selling triple the number of Black Panther when we put this Civil War crossover on it than we sell on the merits of the series itself. Let's have lots of crossovers.
And that makes
until
perfect,
this stops happening.
Yeah, that makes perfect business sense. My concern with that, though, is we seem to already be in the period of consecutive event after event after event that eventually we're either going to hit events that just fail big time or are still successful but aren't doing the kind of bumps for the other titles, crossover titles, that they had been. And I'm afraid that if the publishers aren't careful, they may milk the sales bump from the events too much, and it'll negate the power and the sales benefit of it. You know, it's one thing to say, gosh, Civil War, big major event, I'll buy all the crossovers. But, I mean, how many people are going to do that each and every month, you know, with the next major events coming down the pike or whatever? So, but, I mean, from a business standpoint, they should do whatever they can to maximize their sales each and every issue. And we're seeing that not only with events, but multiple covers. I think 2006 showed a lot more alternate covers and variant covers and whatnot, both on major events and, you know, even non-major event titles across the board. Much more than I think we'd seen in previous years.
So looking at Annihilation, you know, I don't see any issues of Annihilation on here, and issues of Annihilation on the top 300. There were issues of Annihilation that came out, and, you know, this is an example of what you were just talking about with the crossover saturation, or the event saturation anyway. I mean, there's...
The highest selling Annihilation thing I see on over the course of 2006 would have been the prologue, which did 63,900 units, which is just about, you know, 6,000 below the threshold to get onto the top 300 comics for the year. So yeah, there's an event that didn't make the charts for the year, which is very interesting.
But, you know, say what you will about the lateness on Civil War, but you look at it, and the art is really nice. The writing, it's a decent story. It's got good art. It's relatively easy to follow. You know, it's the high concept of it is, you know, you got the superhero battle, you know, the registration versus the people who are opposed to it. It's easy for people to grasp.
Yes.
And it's got very recognizable heroes. You reach into Annihilation, and you've got a relatively convoluted plot. The art is relatively inconsistent between the series. It's not the A-list artists, I would say. And it's, for someone who's not really steeped in Marvel lore, it's pretty difficult to follow what the heck is going on in that series.
I would totally agree with that. And again, you're right. I mean, Civil War was such an easy sell in terms of, you know, getting the core concept into a two- or three-sentence sales pitch, which is something that, you know, I think contributed greatly to the success of the series. I was very pleased when Joe Quesada was on the Colbert Report and gave a nice, quick, succinct, and entertaining pitch for the series on the show. You know, how much of that translated into sales and stuff, I mean, there's really no way of knowing for sure, although certainly I think that helped contribute to the success. You know, I put Civil War as the biggest success and the biggest failure for Marvel for 2006. The success part is obvious. It was a good series. It sold very well. Every issue of it sold over 250,000 units. That's phenomenal. That's excellent. The failure part for me was the delay. Not so much that there was the delay, but imagine how well Civil War would have done if issues 6 and 7 were included in these totals, if there hadn't been that 2-month delay between issues 4 and 5. you know, if all of the other crossover titles had also fallen into 2006 for Marvel.
I have a bit of a... I wonder at the back of my mind, though, if the mere fact that Civil War was so delayed might not have helped pump up the sales of a lot of those crossover titles more so than if it had shipped on time. Because if you think of it, and I felt this way too, I mean, you're really into the Civil War story, and it's like there's no issue of Civil War anywhere to be found. You know, you'll buy pretty much anything to get that extra little, you know, tidbit of Civil War plot development coming along.
Right, right.
And people are buying these crossovers like mad because there is no other outlet for their Civil War buying dollar. Now, if that had shipped every month, month in, month out on schedule, would everyone have bought Civil War and six or seven or eight crossover titles all in the same month where they're now buying, you know, 8-10 Civil War comics in the same month? I'm not so sure.
No, that's a very good point, because the expanded timeline allowed people to, you know, spend their money at a slower rate, whereas you're right, if it had happened and ended back in, I guess it should have ended in September or October, people may not have simply been able to afford that many comics in that short a time frame. Or even if they could, they may not have been willing to shell out that much cash that quickly. I wish there was some way to really gauge if that was a factor or not. Flip side, you know, if they had simply scheduled it to come out every 6 weeks versus every four or something along those lines, potentially they could have had the best of both worlds.
Mm-hmm.
They could have had a little bit more time to get the issues out, potentially not have had the delays, had given the readers more time to, you know, distribute their spending across time or whatever. It just seems that while the delay may not have hurt sales, it certainly turned Civil War from an unqualified success to a qualified success. And I think that's unfortunate. I would have been much happier if Marvel had just knocked this out of the park and there was no, you know, detracting aspect of it. I mean, there's no question from a sales and financial perspective, it was the most successful series of the year. Because even though 52 outsold it and brought in more dollars, it took nearly seven times the number of issues to do so.
On a piece-by-piece basis, Civil War, and also the fact, you know, you are not, like I pointed out before, you're not factoring in all the ancillary crossover sales
into
Civil War. You know, you add those in, and it totally blows 52 away. Just the concept of Civil War brought in way more dollars than the concept of 52.
Agreed. I agree with that entirely.
One thing I am a little disappointed about, and it gets out of the numbers, but given that there is so much time in 52, I mean, not in the Civil War, with all the late shipping things, you'd think that editorial would have been able to prevent some of these, like, really glaring continuity glitches, like the Black Goliath thing being different in the Frontline issue versus the Civil War issue and things like that. That is just surprising to me that, you know, things like that slide through, and it's just sloppy compared to 52, which, you know, is an editorial masterpiece as far as I can tell, just the way that they've got all that stuff very tightly controlled.
Oh, I agree with you entirely. There are so many more plot points and interconnectedness and just details to keep track of in 52, and I would be hard-pressed to name a single continuity error in that series. Now, certainly you've got a ton of titles with the crossovers involved in Civil War. It's a big job, no two ways about that, but some of the errors in continuity and stuff were just so major. I was astonished. And some of it, I think, was easily avoidable if they had simply taken some time. I mean, and by this, I mean maybe a day. To have some artist, be it Steve Niven or somebody else, just do a couple of thumbnails on, okay, this is what, you know, the prison's going to look like. You know, major plot points. When they kill this guy, this is how it happens. When this guy unmasks, this is who's there, this is how it happens. And not even every plot point, but the ones that are...
People are going to notice because they're so big.
Exactly. You know? That are big and show up in multiple comics. And it seems to me that it would have been reasonably easy, once you've broken down the story, which clearly they had to do, to identify those, spend a little bit of time, and just make sure, you know, everyone's coordinated on that. I have major issues with some of the editorial decisions that went on with Civil War, both in terms of the delay, in terms of how they addressed it, in terms of the continuity things, and even how they solicited some of the secondary, you know, one-shots and whatnot. There were titles such as Civil War Choosing Sides, and I think one or two others, that never made it into previews. Now, as somebody who pre-orders his comics that way, you know, these things can fly under my radar. And you know, I like to think I pay attention to what's coming out. I think Marvel could have and should have put it into previews, even if it was a, you know, a retro solicitation or whatever.
And you're talking about a consumer issue of previews, because they did apparently release behind-the-scenes alerts to the retailer, so they obviously could order
it. Well, technically those alerts are in, I think it's called Previews Plus these days, which goes in the weekly newsletter to the distributors and is available to consumers on the Diamond website. But that's something you kind of got to, you know, from a reader perspective, go hunt down.
Yeah, and I would never have, I didn't see that, you know.
Yeah, I mean, there's a level even to my, you know, data collection, you know, on this kind of stuff. I just simply don't remember to go hit that, you know, hidden little part of the Diamond website every week to go find out what may possibly have been, you know, kind of snuck in the back door on the solicitations. Yeah, I think they could have handled that better. But, I mean, even so, they by and large did a very good job. But certainly in terms of average dollars per issue, Civil War itself is the front runner. And then what's interesting is the front runner on that for DC is the Infinite Crisis Secret Files special, which I find quite surprising, because typically Secret Files are not notoriously, you know, hot sellers. So all in all, it was a good year for comics. Marvel and DC did very strong, led, of course, by their major event titles. It would have been nice to see a stronger independent presence, but, you know, we get what we get. So that's pretty much all I got. You got anything else, Bob?
Just some things I'm noticing on the top comics by title thing that kind of stood out for me. And
okay.
They're outside the context of Marvel and DC, but I found it very interesting that the Red Sonja franchise over at Dynamite, they sold $1.3 million of the core Red Sonja titles. And if you add in the one-shots and such that came out, it topped $2 million of Red Sonja books. And that's a decent amount of money to be making off of that title. It's on par with Star Wars, because you add in all the different Star Wars titles Dark Horse put out, you know, it was about $2.4 million, close to $2.5 million.
Dynamite's doing pretty well with their licensed titles. They're certainly, you know, establishing themselves using those existing brands, which I think is a smart move. They would not be the first small press publisher to, you know, establish themselves and survive based on a licensed property.
Yep, and that's interesting that kind of a small indie publisher. I mean, they only put out a couple of titles like that, but I mean, they're doing relatively well for themselves, and certainly there's tremendous amount of variant cover that plays into that, but it's still notable.
Yeah.
That was the only thing I really noticed there. Was kind of an outlier, because I was kind of surprised when I saw how many, how much dollars, you know, in that total dollars column that Red Sonja title was accounting for.
No, I certainly think Dynamite, between Red Sonja, Battlestar Galactica, Lone Ranger, I think they've got one or two other licensed properties.
Yeah, and they only had, you know, Battlestar Galactica, for instance. I mean, they only had four issues of Battlestar and then a one-shot come out in the year. But, you know, it's $350,000. There are quite a few more Red Sonja titles. So, I mean, it's up there. You know, if you had a full year worth of Battlestar Galactica, that could have come into some decent money. It would have been around $1 million.
Yeah, certainly. I think, you know, using a licensed property for small press publishers, not a bad move. It gets them some notice and some stability, presumably, in terms of sales and whatnot.
Now, that was all I had.
Cool. All right, that wraps up the comics section. Once again, I really want to thank Bob for taking the time to join me in discussing the comic book sales for 2006. I always enjoy talking about comics with him, and hopefully you guys enjoyed our discussion. For the second part, here's the discussion that Chris and I had, covering the trades, hardbacks, graphic novels, and related collected comics editions on the 2006 sales. So, top 200 trades, there are two or three things that really stood out to me. The first thing I want to talk about is down at rank 39, Batman Hush Volume 2. What was really interesting about this, not once did this item hit the monthly top 100 trades list. This was completely invisible during the year.
The Hush Returns one?
This is the second half of the Hush storyline, I believe.
Yeah, you're talking about Hush Returns, not Hush, right?
I'm talking about Batman Hush Volume 2, which I thought was the second six issues of the 12 that Jim Lee and stuff did in
Batman. What number is that?
Down at 39.
39. Oh, okay. That's confusing, because at 32, there's Hush.
Oh, yeah. There's Hush Returns.
At 35, there's Hush Returns, and at 40, there's Hush 2.
That guy just won't shut up. No, I'm just kidding. that is confusing.
Okay. You're talking about Hush 2.
Hush, yeah, Hush Volume 2.
Got it.
And okay. What I found interesting, not only did Hush show up so much and showing its popular thing, but this particular trade, again, never showed up on the monthly lists. Now, as best I can estimate, it had to do around 8,600 units to rank as it did. I think this had to do, based on how it ranked and stuff, about 8,600 units. Now, this is fuzzy math, inexact, ballpark. I'm not even going to claim it's an estimate. We'll use ballpark. That's a nice term. This is the highest ranked any item did without showing up on the monthly list. Now, I want to point out that this was the highest ranked item, not New Avengers Volume 1, that Brian Hibbs pointed out in his recent Tilting at Windmills column. He thought it was Avengers up at 19, New Avengers Volume 1 Breakout, and he basically missed the 5,900 units it did back in January. And again, he's probably doing some of this by hand, so overlooking one item, not hard to do. I think it ranked fourth that month. But his point still remains that, you know, you can have things that do very good. I mean, this again, Matt and Hush ranked at 39, and still be completely invisible on the monthly charts.
Huh.
Now, to me, this means that perhaps Diamond should think about extending the monthly charts down to 200 items or something like that.
You make a good case for it, yeah.
Yeah. So I thought that was pretty interesting stuff. The other thing that really caught my eye on the top 200 trades was items 4 and 8 and 3 and 6, my mistake. Fables 1001 Nights of Snowfall hardcover and the Halo graphic novel hardcover. Mm-hmm. Both of those did in the ballpark of about 20 or 21,000 units. Both of those are original content hardbacks. So this is stuff that went direct to hardcover, never having seen print anywhere else. This shows that there is, again, a market for that kind of original material. Now, I think at some point we're going to see a tipping point. Now, we could be a good 5-10 years away from this, but at some point I think the collected market, be it trade or hardback, is going to take an increased precedence over the monthly books, and the publishers may need to start being, basing their finances and their budgeting, etc., on the sales of the hardbacks and the trades. This shows there is some potential for that. So I see that as very, very promising. Now, for non-manga, it seems like if there's not as many original content books or direct to hardcover kind of properties out there as I think or would expect there to be at this point. So to see them ranked as highly as they just did, very, very promising. The other thing I found exceedingly humorous, both in a good way and a bad way. Good for one person in particular, bad for everyone else at that company, I think, is if you look at the 8 entries that Image Comic had on this list, the top 5, which came in at ranks 9, 12, 13, 15, and 17, respectively, are Walking Dead's Volume 1, 5, 4, 2, and 3. The other 3 items that show up on the list for Image came in at number 95 with Invincible Volume 6, rank 181 with Invincible Volume 1, which never showed up on any of the monthly lists for the year, and right below that at rank 182, Invincible Volume 7. All 8 items from Image were from Robert Kirkman.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, not a single other creator showed up on the list from Image. And, I mean, if that doesn't show just how successful he is for them, I don't think anything will. All in all, the breakdown was pretty interesting. DC came in fairly strong with about 92 items on the list. Marvel had 52 items, which is actually kind of ironic, 52 for Marvel. Viz had 19, Dark Horse had 11, Image again had the 8, and then from there it kind of drops off. Let's see. I'll do a quick scan down the list. Was there anything that really surprised you on this list, Chris?
I guess what surprised me, John, is coming at number 2. Number 1 doesn't surprise me, V for Vendetta. Number 2, Marvel Zombies, and this probably takes into account both printings of the book.
Almost right? Certainly, yes, I would think
yeah.
so.
Yeah, okay. So take that away. I guess what I'm trying to get at is what book in the top 15 has had one printing?
Ooh,
you know what I mean?
I'll go out on the limb and say it's number 8, which is Watchmen.
I'll go out on a limb and say that. It's probably,
I would probably say, Fables Volume 7 is an Arabian Nights and Days.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking, too.
Everything else, although Serenity from Dark Horse, is possible, as is Family Guy. Mm-hmm. I just don't follow the when they get new printings and stuff, because the information I get from Diamond is woefully inconsistent on that, if it even indicates that at all.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as far as V for Vendetta goes, I think clearly this has a lot to do with the movie coming out.
Oh, of course. Oh, yeah.
It would have made the list otherwise, but no way.
And Serenity got a bump, too, from the DVD sales from this TV show and everything, too. Oh, yeah.
Did those come out during this year? Because I thought the movie and the DVDs and stuff were last year.
It could have been.
Certainly, it's licensed property.
But this Serenity trade was the filler between the TV show and the movie, if I'm not mistaken.
You are correct, actually. Yeah, I am mistaken. Okay. This is back from October 5 when it was solicited. So,
okay.
It had all year. You're right.
Yeah.
And House of M, coming in at rank number 5, is pretty good, too.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's interesting, even at number 1, V for Vendetta only did in the ballpark of about, say, 32,000 units, which is good, but not, you know, oh my god, brilliant. And then once we get past Marvel's Zombies and Fable's 1001 Nights of Snowfall, we start getting down into the 20,000 or less pretty quick.
Well, Pride of Baghdad coming in at number 11, that got a big push from everybody in the you know, Amazon book market and everything like that.
Well, and again, these are just
got a lot of play.
This is just the Diamond information. I'm sure if we were to include the mass market that we'd see, certainly Pride of Baghdad bumping up quite a bit, and a few other things shifting around substantially.
But yeah, even though this is the Diamond market, though, it definitely got publicity from your, you know, non-comic book stores.
You're
able to go to your comic book store and buy it, you know.
This is probably, aside from V for Vendetta and Serenity, which both had movies and stuff, and Halo with the game, this is probably the first non-licensed property, if you will, that the average person would know about or have a chance of knowing about,
mm-hmm.
which is interesting. Because, yeah, even Family Guy falls into that too, yeah.
Now, that Kingdom Come at 26, is that the trade, or is that... That's not the absolute.
It's
a trade. I'm sorry, that's a trade. You're right.
That's the other thing with the collected side that gets a little confusing. It's like, well, you know, is this the trade? Is it the hardcover? Is it the absolute?
No, I see the format.
But that's part of why I had to put it in. It just got so confusing from my standpoint as to which was which. But, you know, by the time we get to this point, which is around, you know, the rank 25 to 30 and stuff, we're doing down towards the little over 10,000 units range, sort of the 10 to 11,000 units, which isn't bad. This is typically top of the list for a given month or whatever. But it's again, surprising just, you know, the level of volume that some of these trades, you know, tend to do over the course of a year.
Do you have Masterworks or Archives as a format?
Yes, I do.
You do.
I might even have them correctly. Let me...
I don't see it in your drop-down menu.
If it's not in the drop-down menu, that means they didn't show up on the top list. Now,
really?
Consider the fact that your average Masterwork is going to do more in the neighborhood of 2,000 or less. This list drops off around 3,200 units with Ultimate Iron Man Volume 1, the premier hardcover. Archives, typically in the 2,000 to 3,000 range. Batman did, 3,400 for one. And sometimes it'll go above 3,000, but just a quick sampling looks to be well under that. So most of those are probably dropped off under this list.
Okay.
So.
It's interesting also to see how many showcases are on the list. There are 7. Compared to 4 essentials. Just, you know, people are really excited about the DC black and whites and maybe burnt out on the Marvel black and whites.
Now, the one essential I would not have expected to be on this list came in at rank 121, and that's the Essential Official Handbook of the Marvel Universe, Volume 1.
Mm-hmm.
And that did about, in the ballpark of, 6,300 units or so. Don't get me wrong, it's a brilliant series. I loved it myself. But again, not one that I really would have expected to make the top 200 for the year.
Mm-hmm.
I'm surprised by that. Pleasantly surprised, but surprised nonetheless.
Yeah, Moon Knight doesn't surprise me coming in at 107. Godzilla doesn't surprise me coming in at 170, considering that was promoted heavily as a one print only
right.
of that book for the license.
Well, and that's something that the Godzilla fans are going to come for. I mean, I can see that. Yeah.
Oh, and it's also a big S.H.I.E.L.D. story too.
Yeah.
And then the Essential Avengers coming in at 192, but so that's at the bottom.
I should probably pick up that Essential Godzilla.
Yeah, probably should. It's good. It's really funny.
Now, there's one that came in at 139 that I question if should really be on this list or not, and that's Wizard's Best of Basic Training Character Creation.
Hmm.
And that seems to be more of an art book, how-to kind of a thing. I mean, from my perspective, I tend to limit... When I consider trades, I consider any collected edition or direct-to-trade or direct-to-hardback kind of a thing.
Graphic novel?
Yeah, graphic novel-ish, trade paperback-ish kind of a thing. Anything that's prose, an art book of some format like this, I would not consider a trade.
A how-to book. Yeah.
Yeah.
Scott McCloud book, something like that.
Scott McCloud book, I probably would consider a trade.
Would you?
Yeah, I think I would. I agree it's fuzzy. Fuzzy line could go either way. It's in graphic novel format. It's sequential art. It's not so much telling a story. It's more of a documentary version of it. But to me, it kind of qualifies. It's certainly not prose. It's certainly not, a book of cover shots or a book of how to draw. You know what I mean? Certainly the first two. I haven't read Making Comics yet. I need to read that, so I don't know about that. But, yeah, I'd probably consider it on here.
Well, now getting back to the handbook, how do you classify the handbook? It was a comic book series, but not so much, it's information. It's a companion book, really.
It's a companion
That's
book.
That's what it is.
Technically, I would agree that you could argue by the rationale I just gave, it shouldn't be included.
Yeah.
But I kind of grandfather that in as having been a comic book.
Yeah. But then again, we don't see, like the new DC or Marvel encyclopedias that have come out in the past 2 years. Of course, they may not sell enough to be on this list, but...
And that's where I split hairs, because I'd put those in the book section.
Right.
I am so damn inconsistent on this, aren't I? Damn you!
It's good to have me along, isn't it?
Well, it's funny because these are the kinds of issues that drive me nuts when I'm trying to compile all this information. Because something that should be as simple as, well, what format is this? Is this a trade or not? There's some gray areas.
Yeah.
And then once you start figuring out, well, which volume of a particularly a monthly book or whatever, but sometimes even a trade, it just gets confusing.
Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah, that's funny. Now, the other thing that's kind of interesting, if you look at rank 146, Identity Crisis hardcover,
mm-hmm.
which did about 5,500 in the ballpark of there this year, for 2006, that's presumably both variations of it because it had the two item codes.
Okay.
So presumably the direct and the mass market versions, I guess it was, for the hardcover. I think so. And I think, aside from Wolverine Origins and Ultimate Iron Man Volume 1, those two premier hardcovers, those may be the only items on the list other than Marvel Zombies, which had multiple item codes.
Did you drill down enough where you could figure out, how many X-Men books were sold in title? And how many Wolverine books and how many Superman books?
Yeah.
You did?
Not by group, but by title. If you go back down to 214.
Okay.
Over on column L.
Yeah, I'm looking at column L, yeah.
Naruto had 12 items, Fables had 8, Walking Dead had the 5. I didn't total up the sales by that.
Okay. No, but did you do it by character, though? Because can I look up how many Superman books are on the list?
That would be a good thing to do, but to do that, I would have to tag every item with what character it is.
Yeah, yeah.
And that would be a little bit of work.
Well, you can kind of do it in title anyway. If I look up Batman, then I see Batman and the Monster Man, Dark Knight Returns, Face to Face, Hush Returns, you know. So I can kind of get a little idea just in title. How many Ultimates are on there, right?
Part of my plan for reworking my entire system is to facilitate things like that, to where I would have each title, each where I could tag it with, you know, other information. Yeah, on one of the other pages, I've got the top trades by title and by format and stuff, and I've got a high-low average, that sort of thing. But I just added a quick thing here to where, like, Naruto sold, total estimated, somewhere in the ballpark of 83,200 units over those 12 issues.
Okay.
And Why the Last Man did about 88,000... Skimming the list to see if anything beat it out, and actually Why the Last Man seemed to do the best. Walking Dead came in not too far behind, though, with 72,400. I think that came in fourth, after Why the Last Man, Naruto, and Fables.
Is Why the Last Man going to be a movie?
I thought I'd heard something along those lines, but I am not entirely sure.
Okay. I'm just wondering, you know, what kind of... The trades are doing so well right now. When the movie comes out, they'll probably get all repackaged and sell very well again, it seems like.
I would think so. Yeah. And that's one that, even when the series ends, I think is going to have some longevity. Probably not Sandman-level longevity, but should stick around for a bit. Should you know, show back up on the charts from time to time. Or at least be consistently, you know, selling underneath the charts, I guess.
Right.
There were only two absolutes on the list. One was the absolute Sandman. The other was the absolute Kingdom Come, and that was only the $75.
What's the highest priced Marvel book? Dark Horse is 30, with 300.
It would be
$29.99
with a four-way tie of X-Men Complete Age of Apocalypse Epic Volume 3 and 4. Secret War hardcover and Astonishing X-Men Volume 1 hardcover. With the X-Men Complete Age of Apocalypse Epics being trades, of course. Interesting.
Those are big books, too.
But DC was the clear winner just in terms of 92 out of the 200 items.
Mm-hmm.
Which is fairly impressive. Because I would... It feels like on a monthly basis, Marvel tends to be, you know, doing pretty well at the top of the lists and seems to be cranking out things a lot faster. But clearly, DC has some fairly strong properties that are doing very well in the trade market, just in the direct market. And I suspect DC's trades... particularly on the Vertigo and potentially Wildstorm side, more Vertigo, I guess, do fairly well in the mass market.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, next page we've got is the top trades by title. Now, what I did on this page was I took all of the data from the top 100 trades for each of the 12 months, and then for each title that ever showed up for each format, I did a count of the number of titles, I did the minimum units, the maximum units, the total units, the average units, the minimum price, maximum price, total price, average price, and then the minimum dollars, maximum dollars, total dollars, average dollars for that. So, for instance, if we were to go to... I have no idea what would be a good example on this. Absolute DC New Frontier. There was just the one item. It sold the 3,200 units. So that's the min, the max, the total, and the average, of course. For the 75, that's a bad example. or something that has some actual... Well, let's go to Walking Dead. Walking Dead will be a good example. Walking Dead is going to be way down at row 712. It had 6 items on the list for the trade paperbacks. And the reason it had 6 is I bet Volume 1 shows up twice as Volume 1 and then just as whatever it was. Diamond typically does not list the first volume of trade paperback as being Volume 1. Mm-hmm. They just list it as whatever colon subtitle, which is annoying for just this reason. But I've got plans in place to eventually fix that. Minimum units in this case was 4,500 units. Maximum was 15,600. And the total units for all of those put together, for all 6 items or whatever, came up to 68,600 units for an average of the 11,433. And then again, I did the same minimum price, max price, etc. And then the minimum dollars is not the minimum price versus times the minimum units, but the minimum dollars that was brought in by any particular item. So a higher priced item that sold less could show up here, whatever. But this gives kind of a rough breakdown on how things did, and this goes and covers about 776 items or thereabouts versus the 200 that were on the top list from Diamond. This is sorted alphabetically. This also differentiates, obviously, trades from hardcovers because obviously they're different things. This wound up being a lot more exciting for the monthlies because most of the monthlies had multiple items come out, whereas most of these are going to have like one item or whatever on here.
This is just a giant list of information.
Yes, it is.
And it probably took you all about 2.5 seconds to generate.
It took a little longer than that to put together the query, but I'm doing all this through a database.
Yeah.
Now, what's interesting here is if you go to row 202, 203, 204, we've got the Essential Official Handbook of the Marvel Universe, the Deluxe Edition, and the Update 98. And we can see how those tended to do. And on average, for the one volume of the first, it did the 4,600. The Deluxe Edition, which had 3 volumes,
averaged
3,833 units. And then the Update did a not-so-stellar 2,700 units. And this gives a better idea of, you know, again, how the Essentials tended to do over the year. Now, what's really interesting is the Essential Incredible Hulk only moved 800 units during 2006 that showed up on the charts. Now, I'm assuming that was probably reorder activity, as that would have just barely hit the charts on one of the months. I would have to take a look at which month that would have even been able to hit the charts on.
Well, I can tell you when that book came out.
Well, it's not so much when it came out, but which month it hit the chart, because obviously it came out prior to 2006. I'm going to say...
What volume was it? Do you know? Volume 4?
I thought it was Volume 1. It was either January or September that it hit the list.
And it was Volume 1? Volume 4 came
actually,
out...
Actually, for this one, I can't tell. It doesn't give me the volume. It just says one item came out.
Well, they had two because Volume 4 came out August 30th, 2006, and then they had a new printing of The Incredible Hulk, Volume 1.
Okay, and it's Incredible Hulk versus Hulk, because both are listed here.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That's another one of those damn confusing
things. Well, that's odd. The title that I'm looking at has them both as Incredible Hulk.
All right.
I don't know about that one, John.
I am asking my database now. According to this...
I would say Incredible Hulk is the reissue of Volume 1.
It was Essential Incredible Hulk Volume 1, and it was in September. It was in new printing.
Yep. And the Hulk, Essential Hulk, with 3,400 units, is Volume 4.
Yes. It is. Yeah, it took a while to assemble this, and part of it was just trying to figure out what was going to be useful information and a decent way to present it. Because part of it is this, and not only is there just so much information, but trying to get the titles consistent and just cleaning the data was a significant amount of work.
Mm-hmm.
More so than I think most people realize. Because, I mean, my favorite go-to example is All-Star Batman and Robin, the Boy Wonder. Four issues have come out, and there's at least six different ways Diamond has listed that.
Oh, sure. There's only one way you can buy it, though. Late.
Yeah. Isn't that the case, God? I don't know that there's really much else on this page that's going to be horribly exciting. If you can think of anything, shout out, though.
Eternals by Jack Kirby at 211. Just wondering. Because that was maybe, you know, basically an omnibus title, too.
Yeah.
Even though it didn't have the omnibus tag, quote unquote, it was as big as an omnibus.
And that would have come out in June, I believe.
June, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, let's move to the next page. This, I think, you'll find a lot more interesting. This page is the top trades by format. What I did is I took all of that information on the previous page or whatever, or basically the top 100 trades for all 12 months, used that as the source data, and said, okay, by format, be it absolute, archive, essential, graphic novel, hardcover, whatever, were the items, the minimum units, the maximum units, total units, same for price, same for dollars. To try to get an idea of, you know, what seems to be dominating the market in terms of format and what's an average expectation for that format, both in terms of units, price, and dollars that it brings in.
Okay.
Now, I'm sure it'll come as no surprise to anybody that trade paperbacks dominate the chart.
Right.
Out of the 1,055 different items, because of course some items are going to show up multiple times, 650 of them were trade paperbacks. The next most frequent format was graphic novels with 206, and then from there it drops to 68 hardcovers, and then from there it drops to 27 essentials, 25 Masterworks, 25 premier hardcovers, only 17 archives, only 11 showcase presents, and 5 omnibuses, 4 absolutes, and 1 slipcase hardcover.
Now, what's the difference between a soft cover and a trade paperback?
They listed as a soft cover versus they listed as a trade paperback.
Okay.
In other words, I got no good explanation.
Right.
Typically, when they list stuff, they're going to have an HC for a hardcover, a SC for soft cover, whatever. Every once in a while, you wind up with something that's got nothing. So it's like, well, what the hell format is this? But it doesn't happen that often.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when I did this, I made sure the absolutes were only DC, the masterworks were only Marvel, and that sort of sanity checking.
Yeah, that's going to change next year.
Yeah,
when
at some point.
We get the Fourth World Omnibus from DC.
Like I said, I'm in the process of reworking how I do stuff. I need to, at some point we need to talk on my new data cleaning process, and I need to get your input on it, because there are a couple of things I'm not sure about. Obviously the most expensive format, absolute, a minimum of 75, a maximum of 99. Cheapest format, graphic novel, low of 395, high of 24.99. I would argue the most consistently priced format, obviously Showcase Presents, of course, at $16.99 across the board, but next to that would be the Masterworks at either the $49.99 or the $54.99.
Or the Essentials, probably, right?
The Essentials, $16.99 to $19.99.
Really?
Okay. Not a huge price difference, but a little print. Most of the dollars, of course, are coming in through the trade paperback side, because that accounted for 27,816,000 dollars over the course of the year. The next highest was hardcovers at about 6.2 million, and this is again with, you know, the maximum units anything sold being, you know, 31,900 or in that ballpark. So again, you know, the price really factors in on these. Now, trade paperback is such a nebulous term because the cheapest trade paperback was $3.50. The most expensive was $59.99. So I mean, there's so much wiggle room in there. It's not even funny. And you know, if I'd been thinking, I would have done all this as percentages in some areas too. Didn't think to do that. Damn it. Oh well. Next year. We'll learn from this.
For the total dollar amount, you got about $48.5 million.
Yeah.
With everything that's on the. Now, that's just the top 200, right?
No. This is the top 100 for all 12 months.
Okay.
Because of the way they did the data for the top 200, they just gave a ranked list. I was able to estimate how much they sold, but it's a really loose estimate. The top 200 items for the year did somewhere around $24.1 million.
Okay.
And then, as we just said, that's what, about half that that 48.5 or so million?
Right.
I mean, there are clearly a couple of items, because of price, because of how much they're selling, are dominating, are really kind of skewing the thing. Because it's 200 out of 1,055, so a fifth of the list counts for nearly half the dollars. And counts for a little over 1.5, almost 1.6 million units versus a total here of 2.8 million units. So over half the volume. But again, it's not necessarily an apples-to-apples comparison here, because what we're seeing on this data with the formats and whatnot is only the top 100 for each month. There's a lot of things that are selling kind of under the radar on there. Whereas on that top 200, we're only getting, again, the top 200, but we're seeing stuff that fell off that other radar underneath it. So we're not getting a complete picture on either one, but between the two, we can make some correlations. We can discover some data and figure out what we're not seeing by taking a look on the top trades. At where for Dark Horse, where Star Wars Clone Wars Adventures Volume 5 and 6 showed up at ranks 87 and 97 each, we can see that they did unreported sales of, you know, either 800 or potentially 1,700 for Volume 5, 800 for Volume 6 units. So that implies that potentially they're moving 100 or 2 units on average a month. Obviously, you know, it's not necessarily the case, whatever it's. But it implies there's reorder activity happening that we're clearly not seeing on the monthly lists. I mean, you've got to take the data for what it is. You've got to understand the data for what it is, you know. And it's easy to misunderstand or misread the data. And of course, using the technique I used to calculate on the top trades for the year, the top 200, the minimum unreported sales and the total estimated sales, based on, well, you know, if it ranked higher, it had to sell better than previous items, and we know what certain items sold. Or at least what we know they have sold based on the monthly lists. That's how I was able to find some errors or anomalies on the monthly comics side, which Diamond later wound up correcting, validating that my process was correct and that my conclusions were correct, which made me feel better. Because, man, it was confusing the hell out of me there for a while. Anything else of interest on the top trades by format?
Well, no, but I just want, I wanted a question.
Sure.
Do you ever see a day that you're going to see either DC taking over, not taking over, but, you know, one pull ahead of the other?
On the trade side?
Either, just yeah, just company-wide, maybe. The DC is going to get just bigger than Marvel by, you know, half of their sales.
Oh, certainly, know, it's possible. It's,
instead of, like, one and two, you're going to have one, then two.
I think there have been times where that was clearly the case. Certainly, I would argue, potentially, and I'd have to go look at data to see if this is actually true or not, but gut feeling, I would say back in the early 80s, pre-New Teen Titans kicking in, pre-Dark Knight, Marvel was clearly in the number one position. Mm-hmm. By, you know, a noticeable amount. Again, this is a gut feeling. I don't have numbers that go that far back to validate that belief or not. So do I think that could happen in the future? Oh, certainly, certainly. If Civil War had been a flop, that would have had a huge impact to the tune in some months of potentially 20% of what Marvel brought in units and dollars. That could have really changed the market shares considerably.
Well, post Civil War might be a flop. You never know.
It's interesting because right now Marvel is in a very similar position to where DC was at around May of last year,
mm-hmm.
where Infinite Crisis had just finished up. 1 year later was kicking in. It's a, can they leverage the success? You know, are they going to move to the next thing? How is that transition going to work? And initially, it looked really great because across the board, the one-year titles were up. 1 year later, titles were up. Now, here we are. Civil War has just ended. You know, the first batch of spin-off and follow-off titles are coming out. Things now, I don't have the sales numbers and stuff, but anecdotally, things are looking positive.
Mm-hmm.
But a couple of months after, 1 year later, certainly by now, we've got the numbers to back up that, yeah, stuff went up initially 1 year later, but it plummeted thereafter.
Mm-hmm.
The same sort of backlash or negative swing or whatever, market correction or whatever you want to call it, very well could happen on the Marvel side with Civil War. I was listening to a podcast recently where one of the hosts was basically saying how sick and tired he was of Civil War. He wanted nothing more to do with it. And, you know, I can't really fault the guy for that mindset. The thing's been going on for, what, 9, 10 months or whatever? End it, move on, let's go. I think both DC and Marvel are, by and large, neck and neck these days. Both of them are in a very precarious position. Every indicator I see, aside from total dollars, total units for the top 300 comics, top 100 trades for every month, everything aside from those two indicate the market is heading down. I certainly haven't done this analysis on the trade side, but gut feeling, in a lot of cases, the first trade does better than the second, which did better than the third, etc. And it's a juggling act. You can keep throwing new balls out there. You can get a Civil War that goes to new heights or whatever. But if you can't successfully leverage that and keep those readers, sooner or later, you're not going to get the next big hit out there, and everything's going to, I don't want to say collapse, that's overstating it, but it's going to hurt.
It's a strange anomaly because readership is down, as you say, but yet more people than ever are watching Heroes on TV or watching Smallville or, you know, 300 coming out is probably going to be the number one movie of the week, or Spider-Man 3 and Fantastic Four and Superman Returns. All these other ways you can get your superheroes these days are up.
I would agree with that, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting. We've got a widespread acceptance and indication that there's a willingness to enjoy superhero storylines, yet again the top trade did under 32,000 units.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the comics and trades are not reaching their full potential. Now, certainly I hope the bookstore data would indicate that it's reaching a much wider market than would appear just from the direct market data. But, I mean, like you said, Heroes, that TV show has got to be hitting, you know, millions of viewers, no question. Mm-hmm. And we're not seeing any of that translate into increased sales that I can see. There's a potentially huge untapped market out there.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, if we can tap into it, great. I think we need to.
Do you think instead of doing a trailer for Spider-Man 3 like they did last Monday on Heroes, they should do a trailer for Civil War? You know what I mean?
Yes and no.
I mean, I'm not talking about Civil War particularly.
But a comic, yeah.
Selling a comic on TV, you know.
I would think what they would be better off doing is when they license a property out, like Spider-Man, like X-Men, like Blade, hell, like Men in Black, that the agreement is there will be a 30-second to a minute well-produced, if you want to learn more, read about it in the pages of kind of a thing.
Right.
Imagine if everyone who sees Spider-Man 3 get subjected to a cool, interesting, hey, I think the movie's starting kind of thing that basically says, you know, this movie you're about to see, it came out of the pages of a comic book.
Right.
You know, certainly well, with 300.
That's like when they,
I mean,
yeah.
Come on.
That's like when they do the trailers for, like, I just saw the Incredible Hulk Planet or World War Hulk trailer on mm-hmm. Newsarama or wherever it was. And, okay, the people that are going to Newsarama are probably going to buy it anyway. Like, why not put it somewhere else? Like, oh, I don't know, use that exact same trailer in front of a movie, you know, that you're going to see this weekend. That would be cool.
I would be overjoyed if at every theater that's showing 300, they had a display in the lobby and in front of the door walking into the actual theater and the thing you're going to go see. That had the book, that had a clear, this movie came from this book,
yeah.
And you can go find this book at, be it Barnes & Noble, this comic book store, you know, whatever. Something to get people to realize this wasn't just some clever idea some guy in Hollywood had.
Mm-hmm.
But if we can start to get people to realize that, you know, that 300 movie you're about to go see that you're all excited about, that Sin City movie you saw that you really liked, that RoboCop film you really enjoyed,
mm-hmm.
all of that came out of this one guy named Frank Miller, and he does comics.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Is it going to boost sales across the board? Is it going to skyrocket anything? Probably not. But if an awareness campaign gets done to where people realize not only are comics still being done, but a lot of the high-profile comic or movies and TV shows and stuff that people enjoy are based on those comics, they may actually seek out the source material.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think a Got Comics sort of campaign is long since overdue. But I've been thinking that for decades.
Yeah. And I can see from a movie theater manager point of view, putting in a display, I mean, it would probably come with a movie, but putting in a display, how is this going to benefit the moviegoer? How is it going to benefit the movie theater's bottom line? And it's not. It's going to benefit, you know, Frank Miller's bottom line when it comes down to it. But that's why it's got to be incorporated with the movie advertising.
Well, I mean,
you know,
just
instead
like
of putting up a giant poster, you're right. Put up a big display of, you know, what it is and where it came from.
When you go see 300 and stuff, when you go in and out of the theater, you're going to walk by a bunch of stand-up, a bunch of big displays they've had to set up, whatever. This one just happens to say, hey, it's based on a comic too, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's no additional work for the movie theater. It's no additional logistical issue, and it could benefit everybody. But I think, you know, movie theaters should be teaming up with bookstores and comic stores and vice versa. There's a lot of cross promotion and leveraging that could be done there that just simply isn't being done.
Mm-hmm. Oh, look at all the marketing there was for Lord of the Rings when it came out.
Yeah.
Oh, you walk into Borders or Barnes & Noble, that's the first thing you saw was this giant display of everything, and all the books were there.
Well, it's funny you mention that, because with, again, 300 being the go-to one at the moment, you go into, I'm sure this weekend, you go into a Borders, a Barnes & Noble, the movie's just opened, you're going to see the 300 book.
You're going to
see it. Everything. Mm-hmm. Now, how many comic book stores do you think you're going to be able to go into and have that same sort of experience?
Right.
You know, I'm sure some will. I'm sure a lot of the smarter ones will. I'm sure a lot of other ones, I'm not even going to phase them. Mm-hmm. So, which is unfortunate. We'll move on to the next page, top chart by month. Okay, this is basically, and I've got some charts to back this up, because those are going to be easier to read. What I did is I basically took for every month the number of items, number of units, number of dollars, both for DC, Marvel, and total, and just what they were, how they compared to the previous month and the same month of the previous year. If we go to the first chart I've got, it's top trade units by month, and we see DC, Marvel, and total. And what we notice is, you know, in some months DC's ahead, in some months Marvel's ahead. Yeah, by and large, it's not that far apart, and any huge gain one gets one month is typically, you know, the other one the next sort of thing. And we see a little bit of a cyclical thing going with the overall totals for the number of units, with the highest being probably, I'm going to say, in, I guess it was August, at about 270,000 units total. So, I mean, by and large, it was a pretty good year for comics. Certainly, DC, in terms of units, was up from in 2006 from 2005 by around, I'm going to say, 47,300 units or so. Dollar-wise, they brought in probably another 1.2 million or so over 2005. Marvel, on the other hand, did fairly well too. I'm gonna scroll this a little so I can see everything. They brought in a much bigger unit increase. It's funny because the number of units DC did over the course of the year was 828,200 units. Marvel did about 824,000 units. So really, I mean, kind of neck and neck there. There's only about a 4,200 unit difference for how they did over the year. For DC, like I said, that was about a 47,300 unit gain. For Marvel, though, over 2005, for Marvel, though, it was a 151,300 unit gain over 2005. So it was. I found that very interesting. Whereas, again, DC did, 15.75 million dollars over the course of the year. Marvel came in about a million above that with about 16.75 million dollars. While DC was only up about 1.25 million, Marvel was up over 4 million or so from 2005. I think a lot of this is just indicating, you know, strength and potentially just a difference on how fast, in some cases, Marvel is kicking stuff to the trade and hardcover thing, whereas DC is dragging their feet a little bit more on some of that. Overall, the total number of units moved over the course of the year, again, this is based on the top 100 trades for the 12 months, was about 2,860,100 units, which is down about 7,500 units from 2005, and as we mentioned before, accounts for about $48.5 million dollars, which is up about $2.5 million from 2005. So all in all, strong year for trades, increases by and large across the board. Yeah, that's you know, pretty much what I got there. It was a good year for trades for both Marvel and DC. And I got the chart for the dollars, which pretty much says the same basic picture. Anything on all that looked interesting to you?
No, it's pretty straightforward.
So, and I think I've got a lot of this information up on my website. And of course I posted a lot of this over on Comic Book Resources a couple of weeks back. And anyone who has any ideas on how I can improve how I do kind of the year-end analysis, this was the first pass through, and it took a test run just to figure out how to consolidate all this data. I think I came up with some decent stuff, but I think clearly there's always room for improvement. So, were there any trends in collected editions that you noticed over the year that we haven't really touched on?
No, I didn't really look back, and I probably should have for this podcast, but I didn't. I should have looked at the different genres, at least of Masterworks and Archives.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how many Golden Age, how many Silver Age kind of thing, and I didn't do that, but that's a marketing standpoint. That's really not a sales standpoint.
No, but that would be an interesting way to slice mm-hmm. and dice the data. As I mentioned, I'm actually in the midst of reworking how I store the data, how I crunch the data, and I need to think about tagging things either by era for the trades, or by genre, or by figure out some ways of grouping stuff.
And that wraps up the discussion of the trades for 2006.
And once again, I want to thank Chris for taking the time to join me to discuss the trades. I always enjoy talking about that stuff with him. And of course, he's got such a better grasp on what's come out, what's coming out on the trades. If you haven't been listening to the Collected Comics Library podcast, you really ought to be. That about wraps it up. If you have any suggestions on improvements I can be making on my number crunching and analysis, please let me know. I can be reached at podcast@comicbookpage.com. Likewise, if you have any suggestions on what I should do differently or the same for next year's year in review of the sales, please let me know. I've been your host, John Mayo. Thanks again for listening to the Comic Book Page podcast.